Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. When the ultimate goal and interest of oneself, one's wife, one's children, one's relatives, and all other embodied living beings is one, this is called Dravyadvaita, or oneness of interest. Please repeat. When the ultimate goal and interest of oneself, one's wife, one's children, one's relatives, and all other embodied living beings is one, this is called Dravyadvaita, or oneness of interest. Purport. The actual interest of all living entities, indeed the goal of life, is to return home back to Godhead. This is the interest of one's own self, one's wife, one's children, one's disciples, and one's friends, relatives, countrymen, and all humanity. The Krishna consciousness movement can give directions for management by which everyone can partake in Krishna conscious activities and reach the ultimate goal, which is known as Swartha Gatim. This objective of everyone's interest is Vishnu, but because people do not know this, Nate Vidu Swartha Gatim Hi Vishnum, they are making various plans by which to fulfill so many concocted interests in life. The Krishna consciousness movement is trying to bring everyone to the highest interest. The process may be differently named, but if the aim is one, people should follow it to achieve the ultimate goal in life. Ultimately, people are thinking of different interests, and blind leaders are misleading them. Everyone is trying to reach the goal of complete happiness materially. Because people do not know what complete happiness is, they are materially diverted towards different interests. When the ultimate goal and interest of oneself, one's wife, one's children, one's relatives, and all other embodied living beings is one, this is called Dravyadvaita, or oneness of interest. So, there is also oneness in Krishna consciousness, simultaneous oneness and difference. That is Lord Chaitanya's offering to the world, that the diversity can remain, but the goal must be one. Then you have peace and harmony. I was just reading an article this morning in Back to Godhead, number 38 from 1972. And that was written by Upendra Prabhu. And he was mentioning there, the title was that real happiness must be eternal. And he makes a nice little comment there that he said, there cannot be peace on earth unless there is peace in the heart. Nice phrase. There cannot be peace on earth unless there is peace in the heart. So that peacefulness comes from dropping the competitive spirit, the competitive mentality, at least the materially competitive mentality, of seeing every other living being as a challenger to one's own happiness. That's really the materialistic mentality, that we see every living being, every transformation of nature as being a challenge to my position, to my happiness, to my self-interest. And therefore we don't hesitate when there's an apparent challenge, something which will bring about a cessation of my interest, we don't hesitate in eliminating that. Therefore, nowadays you'll see there's no hesitation in butchering 42 million babies a year within the womb of the mothers before they even get out. Why? Because it's not my self-interest anymore. Here it says one's wife, oneself, one's children. Now, where is this oneness? What to speak about all living beings? I read that nowadays 48 billion land animals are killed every year. 48 billion. You can't even compute it. It's an enormous figure. And that's not, the fishes and all the other stuff. That's just the land animals. And 42 million babies aborted every year. Why? Because people have other interests. They don't see any oneness in their lives with the lives of other living beings. Everything now is just simply this attempt to quell, you know, any opposition to my self-interest. So we see that the scientific proposal that life comes from matter, that's the basis to a large extent of this kind of mentality, that life has no real value, it has no purpose, it came about by chance, there is no goal, there's nothing to be attained except whatever one's immediate interest is. So whatever you have to do to satisfy that interest, go ahead and do it, that's all. If it's against the law, we'll change the law and then it'll be okay. Then there's no worries. There'll be no reaction. There'll be no responsibility. You can just go ahead. And if anything interrupts with your sense gratification, eliminate it, that's all. Including material nature itself. That's the attempt of material scientists. On a small scale, in everyday life, people are doing it. And on a big scale, material nature is not seen as a shelter or the cradle of life. Something that we have to live in harmony with, something that we have to feel oneness with or dependency upon. Rather, it's seen as something which has to be subdued and controlled. We have to control the weather, we have to control the crops, we have to control all the other species of life in one way or another, manipulate them genetically, manipulate them economically, any way you can, but get control. That's the whole program, to get control and to become the number one enjoyer. Yeah. So this is a mentality which cannot sustain happiness. Yeah. It's exactly, brings exactly the opposite. In the name of achieving happiness, people do exactly the opposite kinds of activities. They do activities which are guaranteed to increase their suffering and disturbance. Just on an ordinary level, people, when they, you know, they work hard all week, and then at the weekends, what do? They go out and they get completely intoxicated. Yeah, they lose control. And their idea of happiness is that the more you're out of control, the happier you'll become. Yeah, the more you binge on alcohol and drugs, then, oh, that's happiness. Everybody knows, actually, by losing control, your mind becomes uncontrolled and disturbed. Where is the question of any happiness? But illogically, people indulge in activities which are guaranteed to make them more disturbed and more agitated, but they mistake that disturbance and agitation for some kind of happiness. Because it's just a different experience from the ordinary, mundane, boring, dull work that they have to do during the week to maintain their bodies and the bodies of their families and friends and relatives. A material life is not a very good option for happiness. That's the point. Yeah. People's hearts are disturbed continually, and that disturbance of the heart is reflected in their daily activities and in their dealings with other living beings. So there's no sense of oneness. There's no sense of, you know, my happiness being dependent or coming from the happiness of others or sharing that happiness, maybe in a little way. But even when it's done in a good way, it's still thwarted by birth, death, disease, and old age, the passing of time. Everything is finished. Even if we set ourselves up and we live so-called nicely and generously, you know, we give in charity, we do some good works, humanitarian endeavor, you know, we try to share our wealth, cure malaria or this disease or whatever it is. But at the end of the day, we grow old, we get disease, as we're all experiencing, and it's all finished in a very short flash of time. I mentioned the other day, I was talking with my mother, she can remember everything about her entire life. She's got this amazing power of recall. But then at the end of it, she said, "But sometimes I think, is it all illusion?" And she's right, it is. Because it's all in relation to the body. And when we leave this body and we take another body, what do we remember of our previous lives? What do we remember? What is the value of that memory that you can recall every moment of your, you know, previous life? When you leave the body, all of that memory is vanquished. It's gone. Yeah, all those relationships that you built up and, you know, invested 18, 19. No, my mother's 90 years old, so she's invested so much time and energy in all those relationships. She can remember all of it, but where is the happiness from that? You can remember, say, it's like going to a movie. Whilst you're watching the movie, then there's some emotion invoked, you know, provoked. Yeah, I remember my mum used to sit and watch the TV. Sometimes there'd be some romantic movie on and that she'd burst out crying. Because she'd get so absorbed in the movie and what was happening with the characters, and then she would cry. And I would, when I was small, I would think, what is she crying for? It's just a movie. But of course, we all get sucked in. Yeah, the movie of the material world. Everything is moving. That's the point. Nothing is stable. Nothing remains the same. It's all moving. It's all changing. Movies is a good, you know, a good title for the, you know, the course of our lives. Nothing remains stable, and therefore the happiness that we derive from whatever we're doing also does not remain. It's gone like a flash in the pan. It's just a bunch of dazzling lights on a screen of the mind. That's all. And when the lights go dim, finished. And then where is your happiness? You have some power of recall, but the experience and happiness of the activity that you performed is gone. So did it really ever exist? That's the question. What is real happiness? And therefore, this statement that real happiness must be eternal is very pertinent. It's the only kind of happiness. There is no other happiness. Anything else that, you know, represents itself as happiness is not, if it's not eternal. Eternal means real. Real means eternal. So something that's real must always be with us. It can never be lost. That's reality. So in the material world, we don't find very much reality. We find misrepresentations of it in so many different ways. And as Prabhupada says, people get materially diverted. The mind goes, you know, to so many other things, but we don't think about what lies within. We're not very contemplative. The kind of society and civilizations that we live in, everything is externalized. Nothing is internalized. Whereas you see the Vedic civilization, everything is internal. And external is just, you know, the concomitant result of the realizations that we get from within. Contemplating, who am I? Why am I here? Where am I going? What is this life? What is this universe? These are the real questions. Of course, people nowadays are also asking the same questions, but they're not coming up with very good answers. Yeah, unfortunately, because they're just projecting their own current misconceptions on a larger scale. Because they don't understand the real nature of the self. And because they have that base point is wrong, everything else that they've constructed is also incorrect. Just like, you know, the so-called theory of evolution. If you talk to somebody, they think there's overwhelming evidence to show that evolution, you know, is a fact. Overwhelming. There's libraries full of it. Nobel Prizes are awarded on the basis of it. You know, we're constantly bombarded with, through the media, through the newspapers and the TV, evolution, evolution, evolution. Everybody thinks it's just, you know, it's de facto, it's a fact. You know, what do they call that when you don't have to produce actual proof of something? It's just accepted as a truth. Axiomatic. Axiomatic. They take it as axiomatic. You don't have to prove evolution anymore because the evidence is so overwhelming. But with one prick, you can burst that bubble. You just ask them, show me the experiment where life has come from matter, where it's proved that life has actually come from matter. Nothing. All the other stuff is all bluff based on this one misconception. this one false claim that life is actually a product of matter. Yeah, Richard Dawkins, Stephen Hawking, all these people. When you get down to it, you pin them down on this one point. You show me the experiment. You say, life is occurring at every moment, billions and billions and trillions of times all around us, from microscopic, microbiotic to human beings and, you know, all the rest in between. At every single moment, life is coming. So you just show me one experiment where you've proved that that life has come from a combination of matter. Nobody can do it. There was a TV series that Richard Dawkins was doing where they were inviting people, invite scientists and other people, and they were, you know, trying to present the evidence for atheism, you know, or evolution. And they interviewed one professor. And so he agreed to be on the show, provided they talked about facts, proof. And then when they interviewed him and he wanted to talk about, that there is no actual proof yet, they wouldn't show it. They eliminated him from the program. They said, no, we don't want anything to do with proof. We just want to make the propaganda that life comes from matter. Cheater. That's all. Cheater. Although recently when he was on the TV with the Archbishop of Canterbury, he had to admit, actually there's no proof. He said, I cannot prove that there is no God. Therefore, on a scale of 1 to 7, I'm a 6.9. You know, in terms of atheism, I'm an agnostic. He said, I'm not an atheist because you can't prove that God does not exist. So because of his scientific culture, he can't come out and say, yes, we prove that God doesn't exist. We prove that life comes from matter. No scientist will ever say that because there is no proof. So immediately you can pin them down. So in that way, then, we can introduce other evidence. And that evidence, of course, is Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, the authority of the Vedic Acharyas, self-realization, contemplation, understanding the difference between spirit and matter, presenting an alternative worldview. This is what Srila Prabhupada wanted us to do. That's what the Mayapur project is all about. Temple of the Vedic Planetarium, Lord Chaitanya's mission, showing simultaneous oneness and difference. This is the essence of all philosophy. It's the proper understanding of life. This here, this Dravyadvaita, in the previous verses it's mentioned other kinds of oneness. Bhavadvaitam, what's the other one there? Kriyadvaitam. So, different kinds of oneness. The Lord Chaitanya has presented the perfect understanding of oneness and diversity and how they are combined together. That's the spiritual world. And that's where real happiness lies. There is no other platform on which happiness can be achieved. Prabhupada used to say that philosophy is the science of all sciences. Every other science ultimately comes down to the philosophy that it's built on. Because science is just investigation and inspection, that's all. Counting, Sankhya. Looking at the different movements of elements and trying to figure out how they're working. How do they combine together? Add this, subtract that, see what you get. It's experimentation. But all they're doing is looking at the mechanisms of material nature. They're looking at the mechanisms that are occupied by life. But they're not seeing the life itself. They don't see the soul. They see the body that's constructed on the by the presence of some force, some living force. But what that living force is, they cannot identify. They're looking. And the further that they look, the more baffled they become. Yeah. When Darwin's time, a human cell was considered to be just some kind of a little glob of, what they call it, not silicon, but, just some little glob of something or other, but that it had no, intricate nature of its own. And the human cell was considered to be the building blocks of, these bodies. But later on, when they started looking at the cells themselves, they found that within the human cell, or any cell of life, they're incredibly complex. More complex than we can actually understand. And everything, the complexity of it all, every little component part, there's millions of them in a human cell. Every one of them is dependent on the other for its own working. So how do they all work? And what is the force that brings them all together and makes them move in this way or that way and do the functions that they perform? That they can't find out. What is that ultimate force? You look in the atoms, and then they saw there's protons and neutrons and this one and that one. And they're all moving. And nobody knows why they're moving. Yeah, they don't know what the force is on which they are moving, which makes them move in their perfect little orbits around each other. And the atoms, of course, become molecules, you know, when you combine them. Molecules combine and become different kinds of forms of what we call life. But what the life is and what that moving force is that sustains everything, nobody has any idea. That's exactly where the Bhagavatam, the Gita, come in. It begins at that point. Krishna begins his, you know, lessons to Arjuna on that one point, that first of all, understand life is different from matter. That's all. It's a simple thing, and he gives some nice examples how the body is changing, but the life within it remains the same. So when we hear that, we think, yeah, it's pretty obvious. Prabhupada used to say it all the time. This is a simple thing. Just try to understand. You're not that body. Your life is different from matter. People can't do that. They're so bewildered. So there's no question of any happiness. If you don't know who you are, if you don't know what the principle of life actually is, where is there a question of living a happy life? Like a madman. When you forget who you are, you become crazy. And then you do all kinds of, you know, foolish things that may harm yourself or harm others. If you become too crazy, they lock you up and put you in a padded cell because you're going to harm yourself. So people are crazy, actually. I was listening to a lecture this morning and Prabhupada was talking about that. So, who is crazy? He said, we say that all these materialists, they're all fools and rascals. He said, we say it openly. They're all fools and rascals. He said, we have our little booklet, Who is Crazy? So that was Prabhupada's challenge. He said, we are here to challenge them, these fools and rascals. Yeah. Who is actually crazy? So if you don't know who you are, then you don't know how to act. And if you don't know how to act, you won't know what end result you're going to get. So this whole materialistic civilization is a figment, that's all. It's a false proposition that's been put up. Oh, you do this, you do that, then you'll become happy. And nobody's becoming happy. Everybody's becoming more and more distressed. Because as they enter into the complexities of existence, material existence, it becomes more and more bewildering. You know, you play around with the genes of, you know, the rice in this place, and then you plant it there, and then people eat that. Who knows what those altered genes are going to do to the structure of the human form? They have no idea. Yeah, they're playing around. They want to make a better tomato so that it stays on the supermarket shelves a lot longer. Or they want to make better milk. Now, you know, just like in the 1950s, there was a lot of propaganda. Powdered milk is better than mother's milk. We've improved it. We put more vitamins. In the mother's milk, there's so many things that are missing, actually. So we put more in the powdered milk, and they convinced women, and especially in the third world countries, don't breastfeed your children, give them powdered milk. Why? Because the companies that were making the powdered milk saw this is an opportunity to make a lot of money. So they put the propaganda out. They convinced different governments, you know, distribute powdered milk. And then after 20 years, they had to start telling the women, actually, no, this doesn't work. Powdered milk is not nearly as good as the natural mother's milk, you know, and you should go back to breastfeeding. Now, this business is going on all the time. That's just one example. They're always trying to convince us, change this, do that, and then you'll get a better result. And then afterwards, what happens? Oh, sorry. Oh, they don't even say sorry, actually. They don't even say sorry. In the 1960s, just, you know, one of the recent things has been that the company that made this drug, thalidomide, it caused horrific, you know, consequences to the children in the womb. It was some kind of drug that pregnant women were taking just to help them not feel sick and stuff like that. And then as a result of that, the babies came out without any arms, without any legs, all kinds of malformations. Now, that was in the 60s, so 50 years later, the company has finally offered an apology. Yeah. Too late. But this is what is going on. So on any scale that you look, there's this attempt to manipulate material nature to what? Some selfish advantage, that's all. That's what it's all about. Whether an individual is manipulating or whether, you know, a company is manipulating or a country is manipulating, but it's all about self-interest. So we also agree, life is about self-interest. That's also the Krishna conscious philosophy. The difference is knowing what the real self actually is and what is the false self. And materially, we think the self is this body. And spiritually, we know that the self is a part and parcel of the Supreme Self, Krishna. And therefore, real self-interest is Swartagatim, Vishnu. Yeah, to serve the interests of Lord Vishnu, because he is the self within the self of every other self. Yeah. He is actually the one who is controlling and manipulating all forms of energy. He lives within the heart. He knows every living being more intimately than those living beings know themselves. Because we're part and parcel of him. It's like the sun and the sunshine. You can't have sunshine without the sun. In the same way you can't have the sun without sunshine. They're always there simultaneously together, but yet the sunshine comes from the sun, not the other way around. So the sunshine is dependent on the sun itself. In the same way, every living being is a spiritual self, but dependent on the supreme spiritual self. Yeah. This is the mistake of the Mayavadis. We were talking about that yesterday. The idea that, you know, well, we're all particles, yeah, spiritual particles. And so the ultimate goal is to merge and all become one, yeah, into the Brahman. That's all there is. But they don't understand that Brahman is only an emanation from the Supreme Brahman. They have a concept of Brahman, but not Parabrahman. That's the problem. Their knowledge is incomplete. They know that they're not this body. They know they're not part of this material world. So they have some sense of the true self. But then they carry over the same mistaken understanding that they are supreme. When we're in the material world, we think of ourselves first and we think that we are supreme in different ways. I mean, at least that's the way that we act. Yeah, that we're the only ones ultimately that count. We are the enjoyers, we're the controllers, we try to control more, we try to possess more. Yeah. If you possess something, you control it. If you control it, you can get some happiness from it. It's a logical sequence. If you don't possess anything, then how will you control it? It means it's in the possession of somebody else. They're controlling it. So where will your happiness come from? Now you can either try and steal it and pretend that you're the possessor and controller of it, or you can admit that actually no, it belongs to somebody else. He's in control of it. Now let me cooperate with that owner, the controller, the actual owner and controller, and I'll get my happiness that way. That's what spiritual life's really all about. People don't understand that. Even when they get free of this material misconception of the self, they make a misconception of the spiritual self. That somehow or another, well, we're all God. We're all part of everything, and therefore nobody's superior, and let's all just merge together. But then where is the happiness from that? Then you lose your individuality. That's not a proposition for happiness either. There's no question of happiness in the material world. We all practically experience that. But if we aim for this so-called oneness of the Brahman, and you lose your individual self, then where is there any question of happiness on that platform either? Real happiness is reflected in our activities, individual interactions, sharing, giving oneself to, you know, someone else, they give themselves to you. That's called love. Love is the real happiness. But there's no love in the Brahman. There's no sharing. There's no activity. There's no giving. Yeah. There's no distinguishable features that can be appreciated and shared with each other. That only comes in bhakti. It only comes in the Bhagavatam. It comes in the Gita. It only comes on the platform of Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva, where there is a oneness, but there's still a difference. The individuality of the spirit souls remains, but the common interest is defined. There's a realization of the true nature of the self as being eternally the parts and parcels of the Supreme Self, who is a person. And we are also persons. And when we interact with the Supreme Person, then we realize true happiness. It cannot come on any other platform. So here the Bhagavatam's talking about oneness. Oneness of interest. Yeah, this dravyadvaita. This is the real platform of oneness. And therefore, the platform of real happiness. Because unless you feel that oneness with all other living beings, then you won't be happy. Not possible. If you see other living beings as some kind of competitors or somehow or another less than worthy, yeah, or that can be eliminated, then there's no question of happiness. Real happiness is love, not on any other platform. Business is not happiness. Business is manipulation. Yeah, so Prabhupada used to say, you can't do business with Krishna. Yeah, give me this, give me that. Oh yes, God exists as long as he supplies everything that I want. That means my self-interest is still superior to God. But when we give up my interest, and we see that my interest actually is the interest of Lord Vishnu, pleasing the Supreme Lord, on whom I'm fully dependent, then we become actually happy. So the Bhagavatam then is the real platform of knowledge. Prabhupada always said this is a science. This is real science. When ordinary science, material science leaves off, that's where the Bhagavatam kicks in. Because it deals with the real self. They have not got to that point of understanding the self, and therefore their science is useless. It's useless. It will never bring about the real goal in human life, which is simply to be happy. Ananda, the realization of the true nature of the self, ananda. So there's no other way to become happy except through this process of Krishna consciousness, becoming fully conscious of the existence of God in every situation at every single moment. That's human life. Civilization. I read the definition of civilization. I forget the dictionary that I looked it up, but it says an advanced state of happiness. Yeah. When there is a development of education, of politics, of religion, it actually mentions that. When there is a highly developed state of those things, that is what we call civilization. So this chapter is instructions for civilized human beings. You are not civilized until you come to the platform of real happiness. We are not civilized until we see the oneness in all living beings and regard them with affection and love. That platform can only come with the vision of Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva, Lord Chaitanya's mission. Okay, so we're going to finish there. Does anybody have any questions or comments?